Welcome to the Bogosity Podcast for the 13th of July, 2015, the podcast that's low carb and gluten free. This is your host, Shane Killian, and joining me again this week is Daniel Wilcox. Daniel, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, glad to be back.
Let's depopulate the news of the bogus. So we've been talking about how the FBI and the NSA lament the fact that strong encryption is becoming more ubiquitous in the U.S., making it more difficult to spy on us, don't you know?
I seem to recall hearing something about the Department of Defense actually supporting strong encryption.
Well, that's what we're going to talk about. It's actually the vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Of all people, he's actually come out strongly defending robust encryption.
Wow.
So, yeah, they say that, oh, if everyone has encrypted phones and everything, then we won't be able to pursue terrorists or child pornographers. Yeah, and of course, it's all FUD, you know, fear, uncertainty, and doubt.
So how many do they actually catch anyway?
Pretty much none, but I think that's a different story.
Yeah, sorry about that.
A little preview. But, I mean, they just keep insisting that if you give the government a backdoor to get into your encryption, then only government can get in and absolutely no one else can. And we've talked about this before. The math is math.
I'm no genius when it comes to this stuff, but that just doesn't seem like how it would work.
Yeah, I mean, 2 + 2 = 4 is the same for everyone. The only difference is this math is more sophisticated, but other than that, it's still math. It's not going to work any differently for government than it works for anyone else.
Yeah, a backdoor is a backdoor.
Mm-hmm. So this happened at a recent cybersecurity summit. Security expert Bruce Schneier, we've talked about him a few times before, he asked the vice chairman, Admiral James Winnefield Jr., quote, "The only definition of us that makes sense is the world, is everybody. Any technologies that we've developed and built will be used by everyone, nation state and non-nation state. So anything we do to increase our resilience, infrastructure, and security will naturally make Admiral Rogers," and that's Admiral Mike Rogers, the head of the NSA, "will naturally make Admiral Rogers' both intelligence and intact jobs much harder. Are you okay with that?"
"I'm good with it."
And Admiral Winfield responded, quote, "Yes, I think Mike's okay with that also. We call that IGL, Intel Gain Loss. In ancient times, when we were collecting actual signals in the air, we would be on the operational side. I want to take down that emitter so it'll make it safer for my airplanes to penetrate the airspace. And they're saying, no, you've got to keep that emitter up because I'm getting all kinds of intelligence from it, so this is a familiar problem. But I think we all win if our networks are more secure, and I think I would rather live on the side of secure networks and a harder problem for Mike on the intelligence side than very vulnerable networks and an easy problem for Mike. It's not only the right thing to do, but part of that goes to the fact that we are more vulnerable than any other country in the world in our dependence on cyber." Which is a good point. I hadn't thought of that before, but more than any other country, we are becoming more and more dependent on our smartphones, on our tablets, on all our computers, to a much greater degree than anyone else. So if there is a problem that ends up impacting cybersecurity, it's going to hit us more than any other country.
Yeah, it's funny because I've actually been playing Watch Dogs, which is all about this, hacking it. Like, everything is connected to a central network, and you can hack into everyone's tech.
Sounds like my kind of game. I remember back in the day, I think it was Activision, came out with a game called Hacker. You know how it started?
How?
You got a password prompt. And that's it. And the instructions said, instructions on how to play the game, none. You're supposed to be a hacker, right?
Oh, God.
And that was it.
Oh, that is...
And you had to figure out how to get in, and you finally get in and, you know, uncover this worldwide conspiracy that you had to take down. It was great. Well, the problem with his statements, which I think are wonderful and I agree with them, but the problem is Mike Rogers himself, 2 weeks later, said the exact opposite in his keynote address at SciCon. Quote, "I certainly have great respect for those that would argue that the most important thing is to ensure the privacy of our citizens, and we shouldn't allow any means for the government to access information. I would argue that's not in the nation's best long-term interest, that we've got to create some structure that should enable us to do that, mindful that it has to be done in a legal way, and mindful that it shouldn't be something arbitrary." Okay, how you gonna do it? I mean, that's the big question here. How are you going to do it so that you don't leave this back door that hackers can just stroll into? FBI Director James Comey has also made statements that are in complete opposition to Winnefeld's statements. And so he's posted an article where he says he's, quote, not a maniac. If you're not a maniac, why do you have to say you're not a maniac? That's kind of a bad sign right there.
I mean, was anyone accusing him of being a maniac? Or... I mean, it seems like suspiciously specific denial.
There you go. But he says, quote, the logic of encryption will bring us in the not-too-distant future to a place where devices and data in motion are protected by universal strong encryption. That is, our conversations and our papers and effects will be locked in such a way that permits access only by participants to a conversation or the owner of the device holding the data. That's absolutely what I want. I quote, we will all have lockboxes in our lives that only we can open and in which we can store all that is valuable to us.
Sounds good to me.
Oh, yeah. There are many costs to this. Public safety in the United States has relied for a couple centuries on the ability of the government, with predication, to obtain permission from a court to access the papers and effects and communications of Americans. The Fourth Amendment reflects a trade-off inherent in ordered liberty. To protect the public, the government sometimes needs to be able to see an individual's stuff, but only under appropriate circumstances and with appropriate oversight.
So who decides what's appropriate circumstances and appropriate oversight again?
Well, it's not even that. It's that there's no way you can express that mathematically.
Yeah.
There's no way you can say, okay, this back door is going to work when someone has a warrant, but not, there's just no way to do it.
Government magic.
Yeah. Quote, democracies resolve such tensions through robust debate. I really am not a maniac. My job is to try to keep people safe. In universal strong encryption, I see something that is with us already and growing every day that will inexorably affect my ability to do that job. Part of my job is to make sure the debate is informed by a reasonable understanding of the costs. Well, the thing is, we already had this debate, like, 20 years ago. And it's done. It's over. I mean, this is no different than the creationist saying, oh, we just won a debate on evolution. No, the debate has been had. It's over. You lost. Deal with it. So in that vein, a report has been published by a list of people, and these are up veritable who's who of security experts. You've got Bruce Schneier, we mentioned him before, Whit Diffie of Diffie-Hellman, Ronald Rivest, he's the R in RSA, just all sorts of people. So they published a report titled Keys Under Doormats, Mandating Insecurity by Requiring Government Access to All Data and Communications. And so they point out what I just said, quote, 20 years ago, law enforcement organizations lobbied to require data and communication services to engineer their products to guarantee law enforcement access to all data. After lengthy debate and vigorous predictions of enforcement channels going dark, these attempts to regulate the emerging internet were abandoned. In the intervening years, innovation on the internet flourished, and law enforcement agencies found new and more effective means of accessing vastly larger quantities of data. Today, we are again hearing calls for regulation to mandate the provision of exceptional access mechanisms.
Thanks, net neutrality.
We have found that the damage that could be caused by law enforcement exceptional access requirements would be even greater today than it would have been 20 years ago. In the wake of the growing economic and social cost of the fundamental insecurity of today's internet environment, any proposals that alter the security dynamics online should be approached with caution. Exceptional access would force internet systems developers to reverse forward secrecy design practice that seek to minimize the impact on user privacy when systems are breached. The complexity of today's internet environment, with millions of apps and globally connected services, means that new law enforcement requirements are likely to introduce unanticipated, hard-to-detect security flaws. In other words, anytime you add in something, you don't know what other effect it's going to have. Security expert after security expert has said this complexity is the enemy of security. You don't put in anything more than you need to keep it secure.
That actually reminds me for some reason of the Obamacare website.
Well, that's true. That was just a train wreck from start to finish. But they go on to point out that it's not just the U.S. Okay, let's say that there's this golden key that gives them access to everyone's stuff. Well, The UK wants it too. And you can say, well, they're our friends, but what about China? And what are they going to do? Are they all going to share a golden key? You may say, okay, we'll create a different key for each country, but then that's just multiple attack vectors, and all you need is one rogue country giving away its key. And you got to think of what a wonderful target this would be for hackers, how much money they would be wanting to give in bribes or whatever to get their hands on this golden key. So, I mean, this is a huge problem. Quote, security credentials that unlock the data would have to be retained by the platform provider, law enforcement agencies, or some other trusted third party. If law enforcement's keys guaranteed access to everything, an attacker who gained access to these keys would enjoy the same privilege. Moreover, law enforcement's stated need for rapid access to data would make it impractical to store keys offline or split keys among multiple key holders, as security engineers would normally do with extremely high-value credentials. Recent attacks on the United States Government Office of Personnel Management, OPM, and we covered that the last couple of weeks, show how much harm can arise when many organizations rely on a single institution that itself has security vulnerabilities. So do you really trust government to not screw up and to actually keep this key safe?
If they can't even build a website, then... Yeah. I'm also remembering the story where they destroyed keyboards and mice to get rid of a virus.
Yeah. Quote, communications technologies designed to comply with government requirements for backdoors for legal access have turned out to be insecure. Embedding exceptional access requirements into communications technology will ensure even more such problems, putting not only private sector systems, but government ones at risk. And they conclude, quote, all policymakers, companies, researchers, individuals, and law enforcement have an obligation to work to make our government information infrastructure more secure, trustworthy, and resilient. Such access will open doors through which criminals and malicious nation-states can attack the very individuals law enforcement seeks to defend. The costs would be substantial, the damage to innovation severe, and the consequences to economic growth difficult to predict. Policymakers need to be clear-eyed in evaluating the likely costs and benefits. And basically, there don't seem to be any benefits that I can really see.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they get to snoop on us, but then so do the Chinese, and how would the U.S. government feel if the Chinese got that information?
Yeah.
Say, if you're tired of the promos in this podcast, well, the patrons got it early and with no ads or promos. Just go to patreon.bogosity.tv and donate at any level. Hackers, terrorists, the NSA. But I repeat myself. Your online security is under attack, and the weakest point is your password. That's why you need LastPass. LastPass plugs into your browser and allows you to randomly generate strong, unique passwords anywhere on the web, all protected by one master password. LastPass sets up in minutes and gives you secure automatic logins throughout the web, synchronizing across all your browsers and all your computers, at home, at work, or on the road. It even securely stores sensitive form data, including credit card numbers. Backup sensitive documents, membership info, Wi-Fi logins, and more. And with LastPass Premium, you can get these benefits on other applications and even mobile devices, and also get priority customer support. Sign up at password.bogosity.tv for a free month of LastPass Premium. Log in securely everywhere using the last password you'll ever have to remember. Go to password.bogosity.tv and get LastPass now. So, of course, one reason they say they need this access is to fight terrorism. We've seen our civil liberties greatly diminished as zillions of dollars of tax money is spent to fight terrorism. So, the question you asked earlier is, what is the track record of the FBI and the Department of Homeland Security in predicting imminent terrorist attacks against the U.S.? The score is actually in, and it's 0 out of 41. None. So we just had the 4th of July holiday weekend, and of course, cable news just went through the roof talking about all of these claims from government that are just vague, unsubstantiated assertions about how everyone should be on alert for an attack from ISIS, and you know, just all of this stuff. CNN just ran story after story after story, and of course, they were playing B-roll of terrorist camps, you know, over in the Middle East, kind of making it look like that was what was going on over here.
They're worse at making predictions than Bubbles.
And former CIA Deputy Director Mike Morrell told CBS, quote, "I wouldn't be surprised if we weren't sitting here a week from today talking about an attack over the weekend in the United States." And MSNBC and Fox ran with that, and they had graphics and maps. And it kind of reminded you of, like, NORAD and how they're tracking World War III and what the attacks are coming in from. And CBS this morning, along with several others, posted this graphic of recent ISIS arrests. All of these people around the country who are being arrested as part of ISIS, one in Phoenix, six in Minneapolis, at least three in New York and New Jersey, one in Cincinnati. And it was part of this July 4th terror warning. The problem is, none of those arrests were people who were connected to ISIS in any way.
I am shocked. Shocked, I tell you.
What they were FBI agents posing as people in ISIS, trying to trick people to convince them that they were in on ISIS. And when they finally said, okay, they said, all right, I'm really FBI, you're under arrest. But I mean, that has nothing to do with, you know, ISIS having agents in the U.S. plotting all this stuff.
This kind of reminds me of those, like, forced sting operations where you pretty much bully the kid into buying the drugs.
Yeah,
and
we've talked about those before, yeah. You gotta have your patsies. So, this 0 out of 41 figure comes from something that Adam Johnson put together, and he just went through listing all sorts of terror warnings. And the news media, of course, we've talked about this before, how they just blindly pass on what they get from government and scaring everybody. Now, of course, actual plots like the Boston Marathon bombing, they completely failed to stop. But you also have the ones that they warned about that weren't true. And he starts in October 2001 about chemical and biological and radiological and nuclear weapons, the California bridges, Hollywood Studios, Statue of Liberty. In 2002, you know, 4th of July. I think they do the 4th of July every year. Stadiums, landmarks, all sorts of stuff. Attacks from Al-Qaeda, multiple attacks, VA hospitals, dirty bombs, just all sorts of things. 40 of them all total. And if you add the ones from this past weekend, they're 0 for 41.
Oh, dear.
So what Johnson says is why these warnings get issued, quote, "The FBI has all the incentive in the world to issue warnings and no incentive whatsoever to not issue warnings. Issuing warnings has no downside, while not doing so is all downside. Emphasizing the ISIS threat at home necessarily helps prop up the broader war effort the FBI's boss, the President of the United States," you know, the one with the Nobel Peace Prize and a secret kill list.
Wait, doesn't, you know, issuing a false warning kind of screw with their credibility?
You would think. To everyone except the news media, I guess. Anyway, quote, "must sell to a war-weary public. The incentive is to therefore highlight the smallest threats. This was a feature that did not go unnoticed during the Bush years, but has since fallen out of fashion. It has no actual utility. What does it mean to be more vigilant? If the FBI wanted to tell local police departments to up their security of the 4th of July weekend, surely they can do so quietly without the chair of the House Committee on Homeland Security having to go on all major networks talking over B-roll of ISIS in apocalyptic terms."
Well, they want the public to have something to be afraid of. You create an enemy, or a boogeyman, rather. That's just rather common, depressingly enough.
Yeah, it's like that H.L. Mencken quote about how they have to menace the populace with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary.
We have always been at war with East Asia.
Yep.
Eurasia is our ally.
Yeah, so whether it's terrorists or immigrants or homosexuals or whatever, there always has to be a crisis, there always has to be a boogeyman, there always has to be a threat just around the corner.
See, you need us!
But I mean, you know, we covered before how the TSA just keeps missing weapon after weapon. It was like 95% of all weapons and 50% of all bombs. And that is over the last 13, 14 years. You know, all of that lack security over all this time and nothing happened. I think we're actually pretty safe. Maybe this is pretty much imaginary and just all blown out of proportion. If you're on the Wi-Fi in a coffee shop or hotel, anyone on that network can get your traffic. Do you really trust all of those strangers? For that matter, do you really trust your ISP? A VPN can protect you from prying eyes, disguise your location, and even foil government sensors. It's essential in this day and age, so go to vpn.pagosity.tv and you'll be taken to BoxPN. Starting at just $2.99 a month, you can get unlimited high-speed connections to VPN servers all over the world, and they don't log connections, so your privacy is assured. Traveling abroad, just VPN home, and don't worry about what those other governments are doing. Back at home, stop your ISP from traffic shaping and messing with the quality internet access you're paying good money for. You can connect from multiple machines at once, including your smartphone or tablet, and it supports all the secure standards, including OpenVPN and SSTP. Bypass sensors and surveillance with your own secure VPN connection. Go to vpn.pagosity.tv. So I guess next year we'll have to put up with the Olympics again. Too bad they do it in presidential election years, giving us a double dose of pain. Ugh. What's worse is all the stuff leading up to it. How the city that hosts the Olympics will get this big economic boost from a stadium and other buildings they've built that they never needed so far, so why would they need them after the Olympics is over?
I guess, you know, according to some school of thought, building random crap is the same thing as stimulating the economy.
I guess. Fortunately, it seems like not as many people are falling for that line of bull as before. And a lot of people are looking at Athens. And in 2004, Athens held the Olympics there. And for all of the stadiums and everything, it was an initial $1.6 billion budget. They went over budget by nearly $15 billion. And of course, all that fell on the Greek taxpayers, and who of course are doing so wonderful right now, aren't they?
Oh, yes, they're doing absolutely amazing.
So they built all of these expensive buildings that are specific to the particular events in the Olympics. You know, the village, the media center, the kayak and slalom center and stuff like that. And, of course, they have absolutely no use for a canoe and kayak slalom center. So, of course, it's just sitting there. Weeds are growing up. I mean, they've got all these pictures of it. It looks like ruins. It looks like it was built around the time of the Parthenon.
I don't want to say this is broken window because it's not rebuilding something that's been destroyed. It's just building something that nobody really needs.
Yeah. They might as well have built a $15 billion window out in the middle of nowhere. Just a window, no wall or anything, no reason for it to be there. $15 billion window. But yeah, it's still the same fallacy as the broken window because, you know, that's a lot of money taken from Greeks. What would they have done with that money?
And I actually remember a video you did a while back. What could you do with the money used to run the government for a day?
Oh, yeah. Actually, I didn't reveal that it was running the government for a day until the very end. It was,
oh, yeah, I just don't remember the exact number, so.
I think it at the time it was like $8 billion, and I think it's more now or something like that. But yeah, it's like you could feed all these families, you could build all these solar plants, you could do all these wonderful things, or you could run the government for one day. That's how much it costs. Are we getting an equivalent value of all of those things every single day from the government? I don't think so. So, I mean, this isn't an isolated incident. It's just something that economists have long known. Things like this always cost more than expected and always yields less revenue and just aren't really useful in the long term. But now voters and politicians, thankfully, are starting to realize the same thing. In Krakow, Munich, and Davos St. Moritz, they've all withdrawn their bids because of the public voting against hosting the Olympics. Stockholm withdrew because of the city's government, who figured out that, yeah, it's just, they're just never going to make back what they spend on it in revenues. Oslo is facing lots of public opposition for their bid. And Lviv in the Ukraine, of course, there's a lot of unrest going on in the Ukraine, and it's just Ukraine saying, hey, let's spend a lot of money on stadium instead of spending money dealing with all this unrest. That's not going over well.
Oh, dear.
So you have economics professor Victor Matheson, who in a 2006 paper, Mega Events, The Effect of the World's Biggest Sporting Events on Local, Regional, and National Economics, he said, quote, public expenditures on sports infrastructure and event operations necessarily entail reductions in other government services, an expansion of government borrowing, or an increase in taxation, all of which produce a drag on the local economy. At best, public expenditures on sports-related construction or operation have zero net impact on the economy, as the employment benefits of the project are matched by employment losses associated with higher taxes or spending cuts elsewhere in the system.
Oh, so it is broken window.
Pretty much, yeah. And this is applying it to all sporting things, not just the Olympics, but whenever a city says, yes, we're going to build this big stadium, you know, for the NBA or whoever, and it's going to create jobs and it's going to bring in all this money. No.
It kind of reminds me of how sports got all the attention and budget in high school.
It's the same thing, yeah. Because they have this perception that it brings in the money because that's what they see, but they don't look at the unseen effects. Matheson also said that they conflate general infrastructure with sports infrastructure as if building a stadium is the same thing as building a bridge. So think of that the next time some politician says, oh, this is going to be infrastructure spending.
Tricky language.
But I mean, this has happened in city after city after city that's hosted the Olympics. They've built all of this stuff and it's just fallen out of use because when they built it, they gave no thought to, okay, what are they going to be used for after the Olympics is over? They're built to these very specific and exacting standards specifically for Olympic events. And so they can't really be retooled into anything else.
It's worse than planned obsolescence.
Yeah. So, as of now, there's only two bidders left for the 2022 Olympics. That's a city in Kazakhstan and Beijing. So, yeah, great selection there. I guess we'll see at the end of the month they're going to vote on the host city, but yeah.
Didn't Beijing already kind of do it recently? Or
I don't know. China's done it. I don't know if it was Beijing or where. That would be an interesting thing to look at. If a city that's already held the Olympics holds it again, do they just update the existing facilities and save money, or do they build whole new facilities? That'd be an interesting thing to look at.
You're listening to the Bogosity Podcast. Hi, I'm Dave. You may recognize me from previous Bogosity episodes. However, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm also part of a podcast, the Superplex Brothers Podcast. Head on over to superplexbros.com. You can check out the podcast for video games and pro wrestling. We also have news, reviews, and editorials and all kinds of stuff just to talk about video games and pro wrestling and everything else that comes in between. So if you're into that, why don't you come check us out?
And now it's time to delist this week's biggest bogon emitter. And this time it goes to Senator Tammy Baldwin, Democrat from Wisconsin, who says that the Constitution's First Amendment
for freedom of religion does not apply to individuals.
Well, what she's actually saying is the First Amendment doesn't apply to individuals, except when it does. All right, so this is comments on MSNBC. And yeah, she said just what you said, that when it talks about the free exercise of religion, that only applies to religious institutions. Individuals do not have a right to free exercise of their own religion. Quote, certainly the First Amendment says that in institutions of faith, there is absolute power to, you know, to observe deeply held religious beliefs. But I don't think it extends far beyond that. In this context, they're talking about expanding this far beyond our churches and synagogues to businesses and individuals across the country. I think there are clear limits that have been set in other contexts, and we ought to abide by those in this new context across America.
That's what this is about.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm not exactly sure what her beef really is, but I suspect it's the stuff like not wanting to bake a cake for a gay couple or stuff like that.
I always remember that it was sort of this video on race related where you kind of set up that scenario of, you know, actually going in there and taking the gun to the guy.
Yeah, which is what you're doing in a virtual, if not a literal sense, because it's all backed up by the threat of God. I mean, what would that guy have done if he just said, nope, I don't care what you say, I'm still not baking the cake? That was one thing that, you know, all the people on my Facebook page just kept coming in with excuse after excuse after excuse after, you know, the gay marriage thing. It was like, who has ever actually been arrested or fined? You know, because, and I found several cases in which people could actually be fined and imprisoned if they officiated a gay marriage ceremony. So, yeah, this stuff is real. The gun in the room is real, and that's what libertarians want. We want people to see the gun in the room. Now, this article points out that she's apparently clueless to the fact that the First Amendment has already been found to apply to individuals all over the place. Just like the Second Amendment, they say, oh, the Second Amendment only applies to, you know, the military or whatever. And time after time it says, no, it's the right of the people. It applies to individuals. Deal with it. But I think there's a more fundamental misunderstanding. We said this when we covered the gay marriage thing. The point of the Constitution is not to grant rights to the people. It is to restrict the actions of the government.
Was it Constitution Lecture 1 or 2 that you covered that in?
I don't remember.
I think it was 1, yeah.
It might have been the first one, yeah. I would definitely have covered that early on.
I'm pretty sure the first one was non-consent of the governed, and the second was...
I think the second one was on how to interpret it.
Yeah, that's what it was.
Yeah. Okay, so Thomas Berg, professor at the University of St. Thomas School of Law, in the Heritage Foundation's Guide to the Constitution, said, quote, because it is now accepted that the Free Exercise of Religion Clause protects religiously motivated conduct as well as belief, the most important modern issue has been whether the protection only runs against laws that target religion itself for restriction, or more broadly, whether the clause sometimes requires an exemption from a generally applicable law. So this is one of the things we were talking about in that case with Abercrombie and Fitch, about the worker who was a Muslim and she wanted to wear a head wrap. Their dress code said no head coverings. It wasn't targeted at religion. It was just a general thing, you know, no baseball caps, no stovepipe hats, no nothing like that.
Isn't that whole thing just kind of an archaic remnant of a tradition where knights would take off their helmets as a form of trust when entering someone's home?
Oh, you mean the tradition of not wearing hats indoors? Yeah, probably. Something from long back then, but, you know. But the thing about it is, okay, the First Amendment clearly applies to individuals. She says it doesn't when it's dealing with freedom of religion, but she's also said that it applies only to individuals and not to institutions when it's talking about freedom of speech.
People means one thing in the First Amendment and another in the Second.
Yeah. And of course, you can probably guess what she's talking about, the Citizens United decision.
Versus the FEC?
Yep. We talked about that. We've talked about it several times. Even had Jim Babka on to tell us a lot about what was going on. So anyway, what she said was, quote, I think it is so important that we overturn Citizens United. It is far too often the case in Washington that powerful corporate interests, the wealthy, and the well-connected get to write the laws. Well, and they also wrote the law that Citizens United overturned, so that's the part they never want to point out. And now the Supreme Court has given them even more power to rule the ballot box by creating an uneven playing field. And she's already voted in favor of a constitutional amendment that would specifically deny First Amendment free speech protections to institutions and organizations.
That doesn't even make sense. Like, most people that broadcast or publish anything are institutions, not individuals.
And that was what I was pointing out, you know, when Citizens United, when the decision came out, that's the thing I was pointing out, that the news media was railing against it because they lost their monopoly. They're corporations too, and they get to say those things. They get to talk about federal candidates within 60 days of an election. But you or I can't. We could as individuals, but we couldn't pool our money together and do it. So if we're poor people, then we don't have a voice. The only way we can have a voice against all these big political interests is to get together in a group, pool our money, and do it. And that's what the law stopped. And that's what the Citizens United decision allowed to start happening again. And that's all that happened. It's a tiny little baby step in the direction of free speech and people actually having a voice in the elections they want without being filthy rich. And the Democrats just hit the ceiling about it and want to back up on it.
And they claim to be for the little guy.
Yeah, no. They have to claim to be for the little guy because their actions don't show that they're for the little guy. That's why they keep shouting racist, because they have one racist policy after another and they have to cover for it. The way you cover for it is by calling other people racist.
We must blame them and cause a fuss.
Before somebody thinks of blaming us. Yeah. So that means there's no way that Senator Tammy Baldwin couldn't be this week's biggest bogon emitter. Bogosity.tv is a participant in the Amazon Services LLC Associates Program, an affiliate advertising program designed to provide a means for sites to earn advertising fees by advertising and linking to Amazon.com. Just clear your cookies and go to Amazon.bogosity.tv, or check the right-hand side of the podcast page for Amazon's best deals, including the deal of the day and limited-time lightning deals on all sorts of great products. So next time you buy online, go to Amazon.bogosity.tv. And now let's cast a confundus on this week's... One day you might get bored of doing it, but I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon.
Sure.
And this week it goes to Cy Robertson of Duck Dynasty, who denies the existence of atheists.
Wait, what?
Well, I mean, we've heard this before. The people who say, you know, there's not really any such thing as atheists. Deep down, we believe it. We're just in denial because we hate God and want to rape babies and things like that. Yes, he says there's no such thing as atheists because of, get this, the calendar. Now, actually, this isn't a new claim. These people have nothing new, let's face it. But we haven't discussed this particular claim before, so I think it's worth going over now. So Cy Robertson said, as quoted in the Christian Post, quote, "There's a lot of skeptics. I don't believe there's such a thing as an atheist, because there's too much documentation. Our calendars are based on Jesus Christ. Whether you believe in him or not..."
Wait, aren't they based on Norse mythology more than...
Well, we'll get to that. "Whether you believe in him or not, every time you write down the day's date, you're saying he's here." And what he's talking about is after the year, you have AD, which stands for Anno Domini, which is the year of our Lord. And if you read like stuff written in the 19th century or something like that, they would say, you know, the year of our Lord, 1863. That's what he's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So his whole point is that year one, there was no year zero. That would have made too much sense. Year one is the year that Jesus was born. The first problem is they seem to have missed it. Because in one part of the Bible, it says that after Jesus was born, Mary and Joseph ran off to Egypt and hid out for a couple of years while they were waiting for King Herod to die. And then they came back and settled in Nazareth. That happened in 4 BC, so that means that Jesus would have been born in 6 BC. But another part of the Bible says that Jesus was born in the Quirinian census, which, by the way, had no requirement that you had to go back to the city of your ancestors. That was just ridiculous. I guess he kind of made that up because he had to get him in Bethlehem somehow. But, you know, just bad writing. But anyway, the Quirinian census didn't happen until 6 AD. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. This reminds me of the argument that there has to be a God because the word universe means one verse.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we have all sorts of archaic stuff like that. We say sunrise and sunset, even though we don't believe in astrology. Influenza, because you're sick because of the influence of the stars. Disaster actually means bad star. So it's just kind of the standard we've just all kind of used, and just because of momentum, we've kept using it. But the thing is, it's about the only part of our calendar that is Christian. The months are named after Roman gods. So March is Mars, May is Maya, January is Janus, things like that. The only two that aren't are named for Caesars. July is for Julius Caesar, and Augustus Caesar is August.
Wait, Caesar.
Well, yeah, if you're going to do the proper Latin pronunciation, Julius Caesar.
Yeah, just, sorry, I get a little anal about that.
That's fine.
It's kind of like how you get with Nietzsche.
That's fine. That's actually where the German word Kaiser comes from, and then that also developed into the Russian Tsar. But, I mean, people nowadays just say Caesar, and if you say Kaiser, they kind of look at you funny, and they don't know what you're talking about. But But yeah, the proper Latin pronunciation is Julius Caesar. Now, you mentioned earlier the days of the week.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with the days of the week, they are named after the seven planets.
I know Wednesday, if I remember right, Wednesday is Odin, and Thursday is Thor.
Sunday is Sun, Monday is the Moon. That's pretty obvious. Saturday is Saturn, because even though our tradition uses the Norse gods, I guess there's not a Norse equivalent for Saturn, so we got there. But Woden is the Norse equivalent of Jupiter, and Thor is the Norse equivalent of Mars, I believe. Tuesday is Tyr's Day. Tyr is the Norse equivalent of Mercury. And then Woden's Day, Wednesday, Thor's Day is Thursday. Friday is Frigga's Day, and she's the Norse version of Venus. And then Saturday is Saturn's Day. And that's what they consider to be the seven planets.
Huh.
So, I guess if he writes Thursday, does that mean he believes in Thor?
Yeah.
Here's another interesting little linguistic thing. Apparently, there was some big cry in Germany from the Christians about Wednesday, because it was named after Odin, king of the gods. And of course, there's just one king of the gods, and that's Jehovah. So in German, they actually call it Mittwoch, which means middle of the week.
Huh.
So they don't have their word for Wednesday anymore. It's just Mittwoch.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, we also call it Hump Day, which has all sorts of other connotations, but never mind.
I remember looking forward to getting through Wednesday when I was a kid. It's like, I'm almost there, you know?
Yeah. I don't know. Once you can become a parent, you actually look forward to Monday when the kids are back in school and you can get some peace and quiet.
Oh, dear.
So all of that makes Cy Robertson this week's
Idiot Extraordinaire!
Well, that wraps up this Sampo edition of the Bogosity Podcast. As always, you can come to forum.bogosity.tv to read the show notes and join the discussion. This podcast depends on you to keep going, so please donate using the links on the website or at patreon.bogosity.tv, and feel free to join in by sending a question, statement, news article, or rant to podcast@bogosity.tv. You can even stick it in an audio file if you want. Thank you for listening, and thanks again to Daniel Wilcox for joining me.
Hey, glad to be back.
Until next time, here's a quote from John Perry Barlow. Relying on the government to protect your privacy is like asking a peeping Tom to install your window blinds. The Bogosity Podcast is licensed under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 3.0 imported license.
Bogosity.
Do you want answers to creationist claims against evolution? Would you like to know more about evolution yourself, or even engage creationists more directly, with actual peer-reviewed sources to back you up? My book, How Evolution is Scientific, is designed to show the basics of evolutionary theory and how it is so well supported using the scientific method. It's impeccably sourced, with references to the actual scientific material, and is arranged using the creationists' own criteria of what is scientific. Using their own arguments against them, see how evolution is scientific, but creationism is not, based on observations, accurate predictions, logic, and evidence. Get answers to common creationist claims, and even a primer on abiogenesis, the start of all life. It's all in my book, How Evolution is Scientific, available at Amazon and on Kindle, EPUB, and PDF as well. Get How Evolution is Scientific and never be taken in by creationists again.
Hey, I gotta ask, why do you do a lot of those? Why do you do that each time instead of, you know, editing it in like you do the commercials?
You mean the little disclaimer at the end, the Creative Commons license?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just because I say it differently every time with a different tone and it just sounds kind of stuck on. So I just take a couple of seconds and say it again each time just so it'll match.
Oh, God.